You talk about being a scientist with sort of observation and hypothesis. I do that, but I also see play as most scientists who do experiments. Effectively, we're playing, and that's what I'm doing.
If you know me, then you'll know my nemesis is Dr. Matt Pritchard. For the last few years, this evil genius has been creating impenetrable optical illusions on social media. A toy elephant vanishes in a split second in impossible circumstances. A Lego pirate appears in a clear glass bowl. A bike helmet is suddenly filled with colored balls. But unlike other online magicians, Matt uses almost entirely unique methods that have baffled the most experienced illusionists. There are no edits, no CGI, and no hidden assistants behind the scenes. His videos stand up to close scrutiny and multiple views, with only a handful being exposed by keen-eyed observers. On this episode of the podcast, I talk to Matt about how he creates his illusions, why they work, and how science magicians like him promote critical thinking. If you're in the UK, you can check out sciencemagicshows.co.uk to have him visit your school. But if you're here in Australia, why not check out njjohnson.com.au for my own school shows. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. So Matt, or no, Dr. Matt, I have to call you Dr. Matt because you are a PhD. What did you get your PhD in?
So it's largely been forgotten. It was atomic physics, and I finished that about 15 years ago. It was using lasers to make things very cold.
You are now a magician, a science communicator, bamboozler of people on the internet. What from your PhD 15 years ago do you think you still use as a performer?
I think firstly, the thing that I loved the most about the PhD was the creative challenge of taking what's quite an abstract, obscure area of science and then trying to communicate it. I also loved the little tiny projects the little problems that we had to solve. There's one bit where we had to switch off a laser really quickly. And you can't do that by just turning the power off. And so what we ended up doing was taking old hard drives from computers, and because they've got really fast arms that zip back and forth, and so we basically cut it down and stuck a little black flag onto the end of this arm, and whenever we needed to switch the laser off, we sort of flicked the hard drive on and it would block the beam. And that's the stuff I loved. It was those mini creative challenges using your hands.
Was it then a conscious decision of sort of getting to the end of your PhD and saying, actually, these are the things that I like. I like the creativity. I like talking about science. I like the coming up with unique solutions to problems that no one else has ever had to come up with solutions before, and going, wait, I know what I need to do. I need to annoy Nicholas J. Johnson on the internet.
To be honest, it was really an escape. I think academia can be a complete mind trip, and it gets to the point where the pressure of trying to get results and just the pressure house of working within the university and the constraints of that, I just needed a complete break from. And so magic's been a hobby since I was a kid. I'm very much the stereotypical kid that got a magic set and kept on through his teenage years. And I'd never had any formal performing training. And so I decided, having finished my PhD, I just wanted to do a year's performing arts and to pick up some skills and be better as a performer. And so really the first bit was just an escape from academia. And during that time of the performing arts training, what I really loved was actually working with children and doing workshops and teaching through that, which then led me to work at Science Museum in Birmingham, in the heart of heart of England. And then from there, I started putting magic into what I was doing through educational shows and workshops. So yeah, it was very much, I was just wanted to get away from one thing and then pursued some other interests. And then later in life, they revisited me.
So really the science kind of came back to you after sort of you throwing it aside, so to, or escaping it. Mm-hmm. It came back to you.
I've always had an interest in it, but it was just, it was a nice year's break to not think about it for a while. And then when you've had a break from something, you start reassessing, don't you? And go, actually, I love this bit about that, and I don't like that. How can I weave my interests all together?
Wait, who are your favorite magicians?
I do love watching Pelham Turner. Just partly from when I first got into magic, it was just, they were on British TV. They had a Channel 4 series where they effectively let loose to do what they wanted. And it was just, I've never seen, first of all, performers like this who were being quite irreverent and gross and stuff like that. So I love their work. I also, through things like Instagram, I've had some lovely magicians doing some amazing work. Like recently, I met Mario Lopez, who just does some visually stunning things. He was on Penn and Teller Fool Us with his salt pour routine, and it's just hilarious but also incredibly magical as well.
And it feels like there are just more and more creative, interesting people, like not just learning magic but creating magic every day.
Also, I think that's the nice thing, is you can just be inspired by what other people are doing, of going, actually, they're sort of raising our art and craft.
So when did you start making your video?
So I started maybe a year before the pandemic lockdown started to grip the world. My main income is working, was doing shows and workshops still. And I would do lots of science demonstrations, magic tricks that have got some interesting science behind them. So I was always on the lookout for a quirky little demonstration. And I started sort of making a few myself, but to be honest, they were fairly basic. And when lockdown hit, had, like many people, had nothing really to do work-wise for quite some time. And so I started spending a bit of time in the office, playing around, learning how to use video, because suddenly as a stage performer, realized I'm going to have to learn how to use cameras and lighting and microphones. And so I used a lot of these videos as a way to pick up some new skills. And if you like look back almost through my Instagram feed, the first few are very basic and very crude, but you see a development as, I guess, as my ambitions got a bit bigger over the years. And also, I should say, what has been absolutely lovely about making these videos is the interaction. So we met online through me posting these things. Yeah. And it's just lovely to have these conversations, people that you never would have done if we didn't have this online way of communicating. And comments from people like yourself have been both encouraging but also challenging, because lots of the time people go, that's great, but I saw a shadow there, or yeah, I think I can see a mirror here, is that right? And yes. I sort of go, mental note, next time I need to watch that. And so over a year or so of people sort of critiquing them, all in good humor and wanting the best from it, has helped accelerate my craft.
You mentioned your ambitions. What are your, do you have ambitions with these videos? Because normally when someone is a magician on social media, it's usually very much focused on a brand or an image. It's like they're trying to sell something, even if it is just the idea of themselves. Whereas with you, it feels as if the illusion, the impossible moment that you're trying to create is the most important thing, and all the other stuff is kind of secondary to it. Would that be correct? Or do you have other
things?
So.
I think one thing I should say, I'm a terrible business person. And so I'm rubbish at having strategies and long-term plans. And so that doesn't feature just because I'm bad at it. I think also I hate viewing stuff where you can see a very obvious attempt to try and get money from you, that it's sort of blatant marketing. But I think ultimately, I'm having fun and I'm enjoying making these videos, and the fact that I get to share it with other people, that's secondary. And so for me during lockdown, it was very much a creative outlet and a way of having conversations with people and just having fun through it. And so in one sense, that my ambition is just to keep on challenging myself and see how far you can push it.
What
What is your starting point with these illusions? One of the few that I've actually figured out, and obviously there won't be any spoilers.
Everyone's disappointed at this point.
Everyone's disappointed. Yeah, click right off. A Lego man standing in front of a bowl of water, and the Lego man turns into another Lego man. And the method, when I finally figured out, was absolutely ingenious and not something that I've ever heard it do before. And I'm wondering, where do you start with some of that? Is it just something you observe, or is it a problem you're trying to solve? Where do you sort of begin with them?
So that one is one of a very long string of development that started off with me just being fascinated with the idea that you can look at an object in two ways and see two very distinct things. So you could look at, in fact, let me just quickly grab something here from the shelf. So this was almost the starting point. Weird as it sounds. So I've just got this concertina here. And if I hold it this way, you've got the word science there. And if you turn it the other way, you've got the word magic. And if I was to place a mirror here, you'd end up with being able to see magic written the right way round and science then. So you get two different perspectives on the same thing. And that was sort of my obsession for many months, of just exploring those ideas. And that led me into different techniques. I started using water as part of a way of playing with that. And each time I sort of did that, I thought, oh, that's nice, but could I use it? What if, or what else could I change about it? And you end up going down different tangents. So I'm very much just exploring. I sort of see it like a tree with different branches coming off, and just explore the different roots. And some are dead ends, some are really interesting, some lead to further branching down the line.
It sounds like experimentation. Like you are a scientist, and you're making observations and then doing experiments to see whether your hypothesis about those observations is correct. And sometimes they are correct, and sometimes they're wrong. And you learn and you grow. And so does that kind of mean that they're never really finished? Much like a piece of scientific research is never finished. That you're always sort of not necessarily improving, but there's always more things for you to learn.
Yeah, I think. You talk about sort of being a scientist with sort of observation and hypothesis. I do that, but I also see play as very much sort of, it's another, I think most scientists who do experiments, but effectively we're playing, and that's sort of what I'm doing. And the thing is, because what I'm doing is very open-ended, I'm not aiming for a certain point and then I'll stop at that point. I'll get to the point where I've got something interesting to show. And weird as it sounds, I can be completely gripped by the build process, the design, the trying to film it. And that can be an afternoon. It can be a week of long nights doing that. And my mind is just whirring, and I'm waking up in the middle of the night coming up with different ways you could do this. The moment I've caught that on film, and the moment I hit publish and it goes online, my interest in it just absolutely nosedives. And at that point, I'm on to the next thing, or just take a break. And I'm definitely not a perfectionist. I'm very impatient in that sense. And I'm very conscious that so many things that I've made could have been better, but I just, when my interest goes, it's just I need to move on to something else.
Yes. Does that cause, this is more just me having therapy now, because I have the same problem. And often I find I work on a project for a very long time, and then you put out into the world, and then there's an opportunity to, you know, monetize it, pay your bills, to to grow from it. But because that interest is gone, you're like, no, I'm all about the process. I want to create more. Do you find that often sort of gets in your way sometimes?
Yeah, I think that side of things, they're trying to monetize it and to try and refine it or make it a bit more practical, workable, I just find it so dull and boring.
Yes.
And I just can't force myself to do that most of the time.
Fair enough. You talked about play and the role of play within what you're doing. There is, and I wish I could remember his name because I know it's very clever. There is a philosopher who talked a book about play, and he talks about it, the idea of a play being the free exploration of limitation. So you need these sort of limitations upon you, you know, whether it's the rules of a game or the toys that you have or the space that you're in. But then it's just that kind of ability to explore those freely. I notice just in our conversations online, you do put limitations on yourself. For example, you have a rule that you're the only person involved. You can't have a second person. There's no ladies in sparkly bikinis hiding and trapped or with your videos. Are those restrictions important to you in your creative process as part of that challenge?
I think the answer is yes and no. I think many of the restrictions is just a sheer consequence of having created during the lockdown, where I couldn't, if I wanted to, it would have been illegal to have had people in my sort of house, in my office, helping me make this. And I'm a dad, and my two kids sometimes help with the early stages, just playing around. But I've got so many outtakes of them just doing things at the wrong time that when it comes to the final thing, then it's just me there. And so the restrictions of working alone, actually making it, filming it, performing it, is slightly a lockdown one. But also I've come to, in many cases, come up with better solutions because of those restrictions, those boundaries, which you talked about. And so it's partly a situation, but it's also now become a little bit of part of my brand, in the sense that every illusion that I post online stands on the fact that there's no sneaky edits, that you haven't got people, like you said, hidden under the table. And so often people might online who don't know me will question me, go, you've got prove it that you're not used edits. It's like, well, basically look at these 50 videos that I've published. I'm claiming that every single one of these hasn't got an edit. And if I'm lying with this one, then it just completely destroys my reputation.
That's an interesting idea, because when you try and establish credibility, like when magicians try and establish credibility in a video, it's very hard to do, you know, to sort of say, no, there was no CGI, or no, there was no edits, or no, you know, it's not really something you can do in a single video. You have to, like you said, build up a reputation for being trustworthy when it comes to those sort of things. I've had conversations with people about your videos. No, that's, you know, that, like, thrown around the idea that maybe that was all part of this, like, long prestige style kind of, like, presenting yourself as someone who doesn't use CGI so that you can use CGI later on down the track.
Like I said, I'm rubbish at long-term strategy, so it would have been good, but...
yes. Well, that's right. It reminds me, I mean, there's one of the reasons why I think people like Penn and Teller fool us so much is because you know that what you're seeing on the stage episode of Penn and Teller Fool Us is what Penn and Teller are seeing in the room. Mm-hmm. And because they've got 46 years or whatever it is of they have a 46 year reputation for being very particular types of performers and performing magic in a very particular way, and they are giving some of that kind of that reputation to the people that are on the stage. And that's why people are so, I think one of the many reasons people are so entertained by that, you know, Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent, where you never had it sure whether it really happened in the room.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And I think also extending that, one of the reasons I think Fool Us has done so well is because performers as guests on the show know that they can trust the show is going to film them and present them in their best light. They know they're not going to be tricked or trapped into something like some of the old sort of Britain's Got Talent, American Got Talent. They would have a performer on and then make a mockery of them or expose what they're doing. And with Penn and Teller, you know that they've got the performer's best interests at heart. And I think because of that reputation and trust, it's allowed performers to take more of a risk of being more themselves and trying new things that they wouldn't have done. And in doing so, they're pushing boundaries because they know it's a safe place effectively to showcase their work.
Yeah, I've noticed in the I remember in the early seasons, the ones in the British one in particular, that they were a little bit more antagonistic in trying to figure out the it was a bit more adversarial, and they even got rid of that attitude in the later series. And now they're disappointed when they get fooled, and because of that, performers, instead of coming on and showing something a puzzle to be figured out by magicians, so therefore like a puzzle with a very narrow audience in mind, you've got people coming in and doing their best stuff. You've got Gazzo coming in and doing his cups and balls, you know, which is never going to fool Penn and Teller, but is going to entertain them and entertain all the audience.
Yeah,
I guess it opens it up to that level. Do you think I know you don't intend them to be puzzles, but they do seem to be taken by a lot of people who watch them as puzzles, as if the point, if you know, your intention is to figure them out, to try and kind of solve.
Yeah, and I think I would say they're somewhere between a magic trick and a puzzle. For me, in almost all my work, it's about trying to get people thinking. And I know through your work, Nick, as well, you love to sort of challenge people's thinking as well and their sort of assumptions and biases. And by doing these videos, I want to engage people in a conversation about how they might work, partly because selfishly I learn from that and get better at what I'm doing. But I just want it to be a sort of a fun game. And so if people are happy to play that, and I know lots of people relish the process of trying to think through how it worked. Mm. Loads of people are incredibly respectful in terms of, if they think they know how it works, they won't sort of splash it in the comments. They'll sort of message sort of privately, and that way we can have more of a conversation about it. I'm not there to make people look stupid. I'm really there to just entertain and get their thinking going down creative paths.
And I think it also, the way in which you present them and the way in which people react, I think demonstrates that idea that it is okay not to know, that it is okay to say, oh, I really want to know, but I don't know, and I'm going to think about it, I'm going to consider what the evidence tells me, but I'm not going to, you know, make up an answer or just sort of dismiss it out of hand or reject it in some way. Instead, I'm going to sit with the vague, uncomfortable feeling that there's something that exists in the world that I don't understand. And I think that's something that you see scientists doing a lot, embracing, well, these are the things we know and these are the things we don't know. Maybe we'll know these things later on. That's okay.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the things I do is trying to create ambiguity in the best sense of the word, where you can have multiple possibilities and you don't have to decide on a concrete answer. You can explain things in different ways, and some might be a better description than others. And I think when you're a scientist, you need to have sort of not just at the back of your thinking, but at the forefront of your thinking, that actually what I'm doing often is just the current best explanation of what we're seeing, and being aware that there might be something better. You could sometimes have two sort of parallel explanations, and one works quite well in this situation and one works better in another situation.
How do you bring that across in a live show? So when you're, say, in a school and you're doing a show for high school students or primary school students, how do you how do you bring those ideas across in that form?
So a typical show for me, I would be showing lots of very counterintuitive demonstrations, somewhere between a science trick and a magic trick. So it might be, let's say, a big chocolate tin that rolls uphill and defies gravity. And so you get that initial sort of wow moment of what's going on here. But then I sort of turn the tables and say, well, how do you think it works? And then we have a chat as an audience, what's going on? And inevitably it's magnets. Everyone thinks it's magnets pulling the metal can up, and you go, well, yeah, it could be magnets. If it's not magnets, what else could it be? And I use the phrase "and what else" an awful lot. I initially just say it, but later on in the show I'll say, well, actually I think the question "and what else" is an incredibly powerful, I call it the or question because of AWE, and what else. And we talk about maybe strings pulling uphill or hamsters in tins, or you've got a remote control car, or the room that we're performing in is actually subsiding. And you can look at different ways of doing it. And I think I try and be incredibly respectful of people's thoughts. I don't shut it down and say, actually, that's stupid. If it's something where it wouldn't work, we maybe talk about, well, you say magnets, but everything's made of plastic. And there's a little bit of a teaching point there about things that are magnetic and things that aren't. And we together explore the territory of what could happen behind it. And then towards the end, I'll say, and here's how I chose to do it. It doesn't mean your ideas are wrong. It's the way I went about doing it, and show them a very simple make at home way they can actually reproduce the tricks that I'm showing them.
Is that
so? Yeah, it's making a safe space. It's and then just encouraging them to ask, and what else?
Mm. Is that something that is important to you? You like the idea of them going home and making it themselves at home?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So in my main shows, almost everything I use is straight out of my recycling bin. It's tin cans, it's cardboard boxes, it's stuck together with sticky tape and rubber bands. And all my props in these shows look like I've spent 10 minutes making them, because actually I have. And it's that deliberate. Kids sat there going, I could do that, I've got that at home. And when they then leave the show, they can then go off and make it themselves and explore it. I have a phrase I use in the shows of wow, how, now. So it's like, wow, what have you spotted that's amazing or beautiful or surprising? Have you figured out how it might work? And I think often, particularly as science communicators, that the field is very good at going, here's how it works. Now you know, great, that's end of story, which is why I always include the now bit. So now that you've understood a bit about how it works, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to change it? How are you going to make it better? How are you going to apply it? And then you end up with a bit of cycle of wonder going on, of like, wow, and then how, and now. And when you then start experimenting and playing more, you discover some more, and you go round and round.
That's great. You say you're not very good at marketing, but that sounds like classic marketing, you know, like hook them in and then give them the important information. And then you've got your call to action there at the end. And then they're, you know, you're just I think the thing you're selling is curiosity rather than stuff on the internet.
Yeah, if only you could actually monetize curiosity.
I'm sure you could. A lot of the stuff you talk about when it comes to education and science communication, it does remind me of our mutual friend Peter McGorry's book, Hook Your Audience. It is a book for what he calls informal educators, people who are not teachers, yeah, but who teach.
Which is a bit of, if you're outside of that world, it's a bit of a funny sort of term, but informal educators is just particularly, I think it came out of the museum sort of sector, where you've got formal education, which is very much sit down in a classroom, here's a lecture, and informal education is anytime you're learning, but maybe not in a classic classroom setting. So that might be you're out in nature with rangers, or it might be you are in a museum and you're chatting to someone who works there about the exhibit in front of you, or you've gone to a science festival and doing a workshop with someone. And so in Paul's book, he talks about how you can hook your audience in using lots of different engagement tools, particularly aimed at people who work in that informal market, but it works for teachers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I think is informal educators like would have to deal with is, like in all those examples you gave, and it's the same with on the internet, is that people don't have to engage with you. When, you know, with a student in a class, if they don't engage, there are consequences and expectation that they are going to engage and they are going to learn. And if they don't, there are serious lifelong complications that will come from sort of rejecting formal education. not paying attention during one of our shows, or not paying attention to the park ranger or to the cool video on YouTube or whatever it is, it just doesn't matter. And so you have to have that ability to hook them and to bring them in and to be both the sort of salesperson for the topic and also the educator. Do you think, and I'm not sure if one is more important than the other, but for you, is giving them the information that's in your shows and as important as it is that sparking that curiosity? Is the sparking the curiosity the main thing you want to come away?
Yeah, I think the latter is. I think there is a certain element of you need to set some foundations with some information, but it's very much if they come away enthused and wanting to discover more and also feeling that they're capable of doing it themselves. I think particularly in the sciences, we have a very elitist view of what a scientist is and who can be a scientist. And you have to be clever, you have to be smart, you have to sometimes be from a certain cultural background or gender or whatever. And one of the messages I want to convey is that we're all scientists. If you're curious about how things work and want to apply that curiosity, then we're doing science.
I like that. Yeah, everyone has the capability to do science. I like that. My last thing I wanted to talk about was your extraordinary win, Best Illusion of the Year contest, 2021. Is it this year? Oh, sorry, last year you're officially the winner of, is that right?
Yeah, so it's an odd thing because you apply so much in advance and it's often something you created from a year before that. But it's a competition. It's been running 17 years now, Best Illusion of the Year contest. It was set up by some neuroscientists who really initially wanted just something fun to do at one of their conferences they're running. And they thought, well, let's invite people to submit their best illusions. Tends to be that they call them sensory illusions, but they tend to be mainly be optical illusions that are novel and also exploit something interesting about the way the brain works. And so that started to capture people's attention, and over the years lots of illusion designers have been submitting their own videos and it becomes an annual competition. And so I've known about
just
this.
Magicians, is it? This isn't just magicians.
No, and it tends not to be magicians. I think it's not actually that well known within magic circles.
Mm. And so you get a lot of you get artists, designers, psychologists, neuroscientists, all sorts of people who you wouldn't imagine necessarily being able to create these extraordinary illusions to coming out and showing them.
And so it's been on my radar for quite a few years. And I used to love it. It was just before Christmas when the final 10 came out. And for my work in schools, I always used to look at it and go, great, this is 10 new ideas that I might be able to use in January. And so I never considered myself anywhere good enough to send anything in. But then as I started creating bits, I sent a few things in. And again, it's that confidence of thinking, actually, maybe I can do something.
Now, the one that won it for you is what the audience sees. And I maybe we won't, even though the method is in the video if people want to watch it. It's called The Phantom Queen. And it is a chessboard seen in a mirror. And when you look at the reflection, you can see there is a queen is there. But when you look at the chessboard in the foreground, the queen is not there. The piece is missing from the board. And there are other pieces on the board and pieces are moved around. It is a real mirror. You know, you can see real reflect, and yet it isn't there. It uses several different methods. And it seems to be extraordinarily specific in where cameras are set up and mirrors are placed and everything is done. Was it as time-consuming as it looks to do the mathematics, the geometry required to create something like that? Or was it just a case of, actually, this looks really cool? And
It's one of those long development stories of, it started out, there's a wonderful photographer called Walter Wick, and he published a book quite a few years ago now where it was photographs of impossible situations and objects. He very much recreated it with toys and sort of building blocks. And one of the photos in that was a cube that he'd painted to look like a chessboard. And just the curiosity in me was like, I wonder what you have to do to actually get the lines to make that cube invisible in the scene. So I started playing around with that. And at that point, once I'd got that to work, the magician thinking in my head was going, well, how can I use this? It's a nice photograph, but can I turn it into a magic trick? And I thought, well, you could use that cube as like a shield to hide something. And so I started doing that and then chatting with friends and realized it doesn't have to be, if I'm doing that, it doesn't have to be a cube. And I started cutting edges off and making it smaller. And then one day, just again, the word play comes in again. I just had it on my desk and I just thought, could I do it backwards? Could I have that same shape invisible from the reverse angle as well? And to get it in one photograph or video, you need a mirror in there to do it. And I sort of put a mirror down and started moving it around. And you have that wonderful moment where you realize this might be possible. And it looked terrible, but when you realize it might work, at that point, you then start tweaking it. And I don't know, I must have printed out close to 50 like shapes and cubes and spent ages culling them in and trying it, and then set the camera up. And like you said, it has to be a specific angle for it to work. And then you zoom in and realize, oh no, I need to do that. So you then go back literally to the drawing board and make another one. And until the point where I got to, this is close to it all matching. And then the challenge is shadows. Shadows is really my nemesis for that illusion.
Yeah, I that was something I found very impressive. It's not just that you make the various pieces all match up, but that you do it in a way in which the light isn't giving away what's going on. That even just without shadows, being able to light these objects in exactly the same way, they sort of camouflage together. It's quite extraordinary.
It's one of those ones that I would want to like revisit again, but maybe with the expertise of a proper lighting expert. You're sort of stuck in a room trying to figure out, what am I doing here? And I tell you what, one of the real joys of online collaborations with people is one of the people who was commenting videos was actually a camera operator. And he basically said, well, have you got anything you can bounce the light off the ceiling with? And I said, well, I've got a white ceiling. And he goes, perfect. And so me being a naive filmmaker thought, you need to shine light directly at something. And he was saying, well, bounce it off something big and white, and it then diffuses the light, and got a much better video because of that.
That's great. So the internet is being used for good instead of evil.
Once in a while it is, yeah.
Every once in a while, look, it brought us your videos, and it allowed me to have a chat with you today. So that's got to be worth something.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you.